In this week's episode of Mooney Goes Wild, how will you celebrate the Year of the Fly?
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today we hear about ambitious new research by NUIG exploring one of the last frontiers on the planet, the Indian Ocean. Terry Flanagan goes in search of our best-loved diving bird, the Dipper, and we celebrate the Year of the Fly.
2019 is the year of the fly, no less. This is the year set aside that we should learn more about flies. Now, flies are important pollinators. They're decomposers of dead plants and animals. They carry out debridement. They help with forensics. They've contributed a huge amount to our knowledge of genetics. But actually, the public profile of flies is often that of dirty, disease-carrying, high-frequency buzzing, egg-laying pests.
So, a busy show ahead of us today. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Ken Whelan is with me in studio today. How are you, Ken? Haven't seen you for a while.
Very well indeed, Derek. Thank you very much.
I know you're going to Seattle during the summer. What are you going up there for?
As we mentioned on a programme a few weeks ago, this is the International Year of the Salmon. So there's a very big event on in Seattle in August, and it's the Salmon Forum. And this one isn't for a different sort of approach. It's not being driven directly by scientists. It's being driven more by the stakeholders, by people who are really interested in migratory fish. And it's not just salmon, even though it's called the Salmon Forum. They're looking at interesting things like migratory trout as well. And there's going to be a great mix of things. There's going to be science, there's going to be management, and there's going to be the interaction really between the science and the management and communicating how best to actually manage these very scarce resources.
Meaning?
Well, scarce in the sense that we have seen in several locations, including in North America now with the Chinook salmon, that these migratory fish can actually disappear very quickly. And the one thing you can't do is take them for granted. And even though you might see thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of them today, it doesn't take a huge event for them suddenly to start to dwindle. And suddenly people are scratching their heads and they're saying, ooh, wonder what happened there. So I think by joining forces between the Atlantic and the Pacific, we're beginning to understand now the way to approach these and how they might be managed.
Are salmon stocks good?
Very difficult to actually answer that question in the broadest sense across all oceans because, for example, in the Pacific, they do a huge amount of enhancement. So there are food fisheries created in the Pacific by releasing vast numbers of baby salmon from places like Korea and Japan and North America. You wouldn't even think of Japan and Korea being involved, but they're big players in terms of releasing these fish. So the ocean is full of salmon, but the question is whether or not the wild salmon are doing well. And some stocks, for instance, the chum salmon seems to be at its absolute historic max in the Pacific Ocean at the moment, but some individual stocks of the great big salmon, the king salmon, are showing signs of being under very serious stress. So people don't really understand the interaction and how the ocean is affecting these, and that's part of the reason for going to Seattle to try and find out more about this.
Yeah, would you know the difference between a farmed salmon and a wild salmon?
Yeah, very quickly.
I don't mean on the plate.
No. In the wild, yeah. I think, well, I would, because of the fact that I've been looking at the two different types for so long.
What's the difference?
You can see, generally, you can see some erosion in the fins on the farmed fish because they're living so closely together. In some cases, it's very obvious. You'd have a slightly deformed fin or maybe a major deformation in a fin. In other cases, for example, particularly the dorsal fin, it's almost invariably the case that the dorsal fin has a kink in it if it's a reared fish. And I don't know what creates that, but it's an artifact of them being reared together and being fed together then. But very often, too, the coloration is different. So if you look at a farm salmon, it might look like the most beautiful fish you've ever seen on ice and so on. But if you look, you'll see that a lot of spots actually go down below the lateral line. You get some spots on the tail and so on. And these are artifacts of the rearing and the actual crossbreeding process. So for an experienced eye, you'd actually tell them apart very quickly. But certainly for the average punter, it would be very difficult.
So you say they're releasing these in millions of them into the Pacific Ocean.
The Pacific Ocean.
But they're releasing them from where? They're releasing them from holding pens?
From hatcheries.
From hatcheries. Okay, so they're not releasing them from rivers.
No.
So where are these salmon coming back to? I mean, if ours leave a river here,
yeah,
They're coming back. Well, they're going to end their days here in the same river, right where they were spawned.
They come back in that case as well. They do actually come back in certain situations. They come back to the release point, if not to the river itself. But very large numbers of the fish are caught before they get back. So the idea is it's called ocean ranching. And as the name implies, it's not ocean farming. So what you do is you rear the baby salmon until they're maybe about 10 or 15 centimetres long, release them into the ocean, let them feed in the ocean. And then because of their instinct to come back, they have a tendency then to come back, and you can catch them in traps or you can catch them in the nets. But in the case of the Pacific, they catch very large numbers of fish in the nets. And this interplay between the wild and the farmed fish is quite a difficulty in terms of trying to manage the wild fish amongst all of the reared fish.
Can I ask, has there been a case to date of any farmed fish ending up in rivers where wild fish came from and breeding?
Oh yeah. Well, that's been well documented at this stage. Yeah,
I thought you were going to say no. Absolutely not.
Oh no, it's been well documented, and that was originally one of the concerns. It continues to be one.
Genetically,
of the concerns.
Would be a big concern. You would have thought.
And certainly in Norway, there are very good data, very very solid scientific information showing the interaction. In Ireland, we're blessed in the sense that our rivers tend to produce very large numbers, relatively speaking, of small salmon. In Norway, they produce small numbers of giant salmon. And it's all a numbers game. So if you have a situation where you have an accidental escape of reared fish into a situation where you have a modest number of wild fish, it's much easier for these escapes to swamp that particular population. Mm. And they've been able to track it now genetically and show the level of introgression from the farmed fish into the wild fish.
Why are they going to the river?
Well, very often what happens is that the fish escape from the cage and then wander around, then they start to mature. And as far as we can see then, they just bolt up rivers. They have an instinct to go and spawn, and they go up into the nearest river.
Even though they're farmed salmon, yes. they still have the instinct to go in and to spawn.
And they seem to be quite poor at spawning, which is, from the wild fish point of view, a very good thing. So they wander all over the place, and they go up blind alleys and so on. But some of them do succeed in spawning both with themselves, and they're more successful breeding with other farmed fish than they are with wild. But certainly some of them do interbreed with the wild fish.
Ken, you're a marine biologist. You must be very concerned about that report from the United Nations a couple of weeks ago.
At this stage now, this is serious, serious stuff. I'm really glad to see the level of attention that it has actually drawn to the issues that as marine biologists we've been speaking about for 2-3 decades or more. We no longer have the opportunity now to actually put this off. We have to take a serious, serious look at what needs to be done. Glad in one way and concerned in another that every politician in the place now has jumped onto the bandwagon. Mm. So that's a very good thing. But we need considered actions. We don't just need everyone saying, oh, well, we'll have to do one thing or another. This is a whole series of different actions that we have to take. But the most important message is that every single person can actually contribute to this by being conscious themselves of what they're actually doing. I firmly believe we can't keep imagining that we can grow economies by 5%, 6%, and 7% and meet objectives that we're now saying we're going to meet in terms of climate change. We have to get used to the idea of a neutral economy.
Well, we've only been going on about this kind of stuff for 30 years on the radio programme, and now it's newsworthy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the way things are, I suppose. But that's a good thing. At least people now are aware there is an issue and we can all do something to resolve it. You're going to be very interested in this next item, Ken, if you put your headphones on. Louise Alcock is head of zoology at NUI Galway. She has recently returned from an ambitious expedition to peer deeply into one of the last major unexplored frontiers on the planet, the Indian Ocean. This vast 70 million square kilometres of open water bordering Asia, Africa, Australia and Antarctica is not only important to the species that dwell therein, but also to the estimated 2.5 billion people at home in the region. About 95% of it has never been explored before, but now this research team with Louise is shedding new light on the mysteries of Earth's third largest body of water. Louise Alcock is head of zoology, as I said, NUI, and she's in the Galway studio. Louise, essentially the mission was to learn about the ocean to help figure out the best ways to conserve it. Can you tell me more, please?
Well, I had a wonderful time. I was at sea for about half the expedition, actually. I wasn't there for the whole time. I spent 3 weeks at sea in the Indian Ocean, working with an international team, primarily from Oxford University in the UK, but also including international scientists, including Seychellois scientists. And we were doing really some very basic scientific research to look at what is there in Seychellois waters which haven't been previously explored.
Who led the mission? Where did the money come from? Tell me all of that.
Okay, so the mission was led by Necton, which is a charity. It's a very young charity. It was started in Oxford in 2015. Mm-hmm. And their aim, they say, to change knowledge of the world's oceans. When we say increase our knowledge, it sounds incremental, and they want to do more than that. They really want to change our understanding of the ocean. And they want to speed up the protection of the deep ocean, particularly, which they refer to as the last unexplored wilderness of the Earth, which I think is a fair point.
The inner space, as we know it as.
Yes.
Yeah, but preserve it how?
Well, the Seychelles is a very interesting place because they're very forward-thinking on the ocean. And their president signed an agreement which was the first debt for nature swap to take place in the oceans. A few years ago, about 10 years ago, they defaulted on their national debt. And a charity, the Nature Conservancy, then offered, the World Bank came in first, but then a charity offered to buy some of their debt in exchange for protection of their oceans, for 30% protection of their oceans. And their president signed up to this, and now they're putting in place, they've put some protection in place already, and they're doing a big marine spatial plan. Basically, they're studying their ocean to plan which are the best bits to protect and which are the best bits to exploit, because, of course, people's livelihoods depend on this ocean as well. You can't just protect the whole thing. People have to use it. And so the science that we did will feed into that marine spatial plan to set up this 30% protected area in the Seychelles waters.
So how deep did you go?
We didn't go terribly deeply. We were around atolls, but we went fairly deeply. So the deepest we were working was 500 metres depth. And by then you're out of the photic zone. There's no light. You're in darkness. So we worked right from the shallows, from people diving in 5 meters to running submersibles, then at 30 meters, 60 meters, 90 meters, 150 meters, down to 250 meters. And below that depth, our work with the remotely operated vehicles kicked in, and we worked with them down to 500 meters.
Louise, in terms of the approach that you're taking, is this an observational type approach, or are you actually taking samples as well, say, of the actual seabed itself, the seamounts and so on?
Yeah, we took water samples, and we took some biological samples. Obviously, we want to do the minimum amount of damage, so we don't want to sample intensively. But when you're working in such a remote place that has been studied so little, one of the very difficult things is to identify all the species that are there. And to do that well, you really do need physical samples. So we had a permit to collect a certain number of samples at each depth. And our aim was really to take examples of everything that would appear on our videos. These will be taken now to a taxonomic workshop where experts from around the world will be invited, so that we get really, really good identifications on the physical samples. And that will allow us to do really, really high quality video analysis.
And in terms of the area that you've actually picked, did you select an area that you thought at least to be pristine, or are you covering? Have you got transects that are covering areas that you think already have been, in part at least, exploited by man?
Yes. Yeah, so the expedition actually covered quite a wide area. So it went down right as far as Aldabra, which is actually very close to the Comores. This is actually a World Heritage Site, and it's, I guess, the most remote bit of the Seychelles. And this is an area that was first protected 20, 30 years ago. So that has had some protection. Now, the protection was really for the atoll. It didn't extend that much out into the sea. But with the atoll protected, there's been very little human activity there. There's a research station there and not very much else. So that has been very protected from pollution, for example. And so we had areas like that we expected to be much more pristine than others in different parts of the islands.
And in terms of the species then, the type of species that you found and what you hope for in terms of perhaps even new species?
In the very shallow waters, it's what you would expect from tropical atolls. There's a lot of stony corals. And as you get deeper, the stony corals decrease. They need light. Stony corals have these symbiotic algae, the zooxanthellae, in them that photosynthesize. And so once you get below a certain depth, there is not enough light to support those zooxanthellae. So the corals change then from stony corals into a much higher proportion of octocorals and black corals. And that's exactly what we saw. At about 60 meters, the stony corals started to decrease and the other corals came in. And we had beautiful corals really right down to the deepest depths we looked at 500 meters. So we saw a sort of classic transition that we would expect. One of the lovely things was there were parts that were just so pristine and so beautiful with really enormous black corals. I mean, some sites were absolutely marvellous.
And in terms then of the larger species, because I spent a few weeks some years ago fishing off Kenya in the Indian Ocean, and I was absolutely amazed at the range and variety of billfish, for example, particularly the swordfish, which are down in the big trenches. Had you observations of these? Did you see these actually underwater in those trenches?
Yeah, so one of the marvellous things about the expedition actually was the technology that was on board. So we had two bits of technology that were really, really good for seeing big fish. One was a drop camera that we would drop to a certain depth at night, and it's on a timer release. You program it to take pictures every, say, 10 minutes or whatever interval you want, and then it's time to release itself after 12 hours, come to the surface. It's got a beacon, you go and collect it, and then you download the images from the camera. And on those camera images, we saw a fantastic array of sharks and other big fishes. But the other amazing thing was that we had two submersibles on board that dived to 250 metres. These were little Triton submersibles, which are basically an acrylic sphere that two people sit in, a pilot and a scientist. And really, you have a 360-degree all-round view from this tiny little sphere. And of course, what you see then is just amazing compared to what you would see on an ROV, where you have a one immovable camera feed that's coming up to the ship. So you're sitting in the sphere and you can see all around you. And we saw sharks, we saw hammerhead sharks, we saw thresher sharks. I saw a sunfish. It was just so amazing. It must have been 2 metres by 2 metres, and it swam literally right up to the window of the sphere, looked at us, and then swam away. So the big fishes that we saw were just spectacular.
It all sounds wonderful and like a busman's holiday that you were on there, to be honest with you. But, you know, did you see anything bad? Did you see any problems we should be worried about? I mean, what you're creating there is a beautiful rosy garden under the sea.
Yeah, so I joined the first half of the expedition, which was when we went down to Aldabra. And this is the site that has been conserved previously. And I mean, I think this just shows that conservation does work. And if places are protected from pollution and other things, they are amazing. So everything I saw was from these very remote, very protected areas. Now, I haven't seen the footage from other areas, so I can't answer your question whether it's all this rosy. But I mean, it was really nice to see that these remote and protected areas really are as special as we expected them to be. And of course, what the Seychelles government did, I think, 2 years ago was they extended the protection around Albert Dabra, and that's much bigger now than it was historically. And so that area will remain protected. And of course, the importance of these protected zones is if you have an area that is protected, they act as a source for marine life, for other parts of the ocean that are less well protected, you know, because there is reproduction and growth going on here that feeds the rest of the ocean.
And an example to the rest of the world. But did you notice any plastic pollution? We're hearing a lot about plastics in our fish, actually, you know, that they're getting into the food. Did you see much plastics in the ocean?
Oh, yes. So this is something that, I mean, Aldabra is protected by not having people living on it, or apart from the small amount of people at the research station. But of course, plastic comes from everywhere and it comes in on currents. And Aldabra is sitting, in terms of plastics, in a very unfortunate place in the Indian Ocean. And it is just getting plastic coming in on the currents. I mean, there's a lot of initiatives going on in the Seychelles at the moment. And as part of these initiatives, there was a team doing an Aldabra cleanup, cleaning up the World Heritage Site. It's been ongoing for several months. And they cleared some phenomenal, I think it was like 22 tons of rubbish. I might have that figure wrong, but it was some enormous amount of rubbish. And hundreds and thousands of flip-flops. And of course, they come from beaches elsewhere in the world and they float on the ocean and then they wash up in this remote area and they get there. And Aldabra is this amazing place with tortoise nests. They've got giant tortoises and so they've got tortoise nesting sites. And these places are covered in flip-flops. That is a consequence of people's behaviour elsewhere in the world, not within the Seychelles. So we all have to think about taking care of the oceans. And part of this cruise was not just science, actually. It was multifaceted. Obviously, we wanted to do the science. We wanted to inform the Marine Spatial Plan. But in fact, a lot of it was about ocean literacy. There was a small team from AP News on board throughout, and Sky News did some live broadcasts from the ship. So we're trying to raise awareness of the importance of the oceans and the damage that we can do to the oceans and how we can stop doing this damage.
The actual community themselves, it sounds as if there's loads of people now parachuting in to do all sorts of different surveys. How does the community of the Seychelles benefit directly from this in terms of information about new protected areas, about the species that might be available, indeed about new harvests that might be available? Is there a direct connection between the research and the actual communities themselves?
Yeah, so the Seychelles Wild Government is fully involved in this process. And so we had Seychelles Wild scientists on board. And one of the aims of the mission was, in fact, capacity building. Because obviously, if you haven't had access to all this gear before, you don't have the experience to use it to its full capacity. So it was a real pleasure to meet Seychelles Wild scientists and work with them. And they will continue. You know, they'll be involved in the data write-up. They will be involved in the future. And they will, of course, be working on the Marine Spatial Plan. So it was very much involvement of the Seychelles. But also, I mean, the Marine Spatial Plan is going to be there for the benefit of the Seychelles. They rely on tourism hugely and fishing hugely. And the tourism relies on beautiful, clean beaches. And we've all seen photos in the brochures of the Seychelles. You know, it has to stay like this, has to stay that way if tourism is going to be successful. And the fisheries have to be managed properly. We know that there have been problems with the yellowfin tuna fishery being overexploited. There are many other fisheries in the area that aren't overexploited. And good management, of course, it's very difficult to manage a global ocean fishery. Do you know that? I mean, that you've already talked about how large the Indian Ocean is. And there are many states invested in these fisheries. And a multinational fishery is much harder to manage well than a single nation fishery. But all the data and information that we're collecting for a Marine Spatial Plan feeds into other initiatives that are going on to manage fisheries.
Well, what are the initial findings? I know you've only kind of come back and you've got a few months to put it all together, but anecdotally?
Well, anecdotally, we've already touched on one. That's that it's really rich in top predators. We've seen that from the submersibles and from the drop cams. And that's usually a sign of a healthy ecosystem if you have a lot of predators. Another thing we've already touched on is that Aldabra was looking pretty pristine, particularly the stony corals. I mean, it's very hot there. We would perhaps expect some coral bleaching, but we didn't see any in Aldabra. And that may be a consequence of the fact there aren't other pollutants there, because, of course, other pollutants are stressors. And when you combine stressors, the effect on the corals is even worse. So it may be that the absence of other stressors is making the corals a little bit more resilient to the warmer ocean. We probably saw lots of new species. We're a little bit cautious about this because you really do have to look at things under a microscope and do molecular work, sequence DNA, that kind of thing, to really be certain that you've got new species. So the taxonomic workshop that's coming will establish that, but I'd be very surprised if there weren't new species in there.
And in terms of the actual seabed itself, obviously we're going to have various industries and various corporations interested in these sort of pristine seabeds in terms of perhaps exploring them and so on. And I'm sure you'll agree that we have made great use out of the seabed survey investment that we've made in Ireland over the last 20 years or so. We actually have an extensive map now of our offshore and inshore marine territories. Is there something similar like to that happening in the Seychelles, where the actual seabed is being taken into account as well as the creatures that are living in or around it?
What would that do, Ken?
Well, in reality, if you have a situation where you have a lot of exploration and you have people moving in and looking for either for deposits of minerals or looking for oil deposits or whatever, there's a real risk in terms of perhaps corals, perhaps deep water corals. So these things really have to be thought about in the round, not just in terms of what's in the water, but what is underneath the water.
To conserve.
To conserve. And I think manage
not
as well.
Not to explore,
well,
in the sense that drilling for oil or anything like that,
well,
or fracking,
no, but to
whatever.
Conserve. But at the same time, we also have to be conscious that there may very well be a situation, as was mentioned earlier, where you could actually direct people towards other sources, where it's a sustainable source of income for one thing or another. But that seabed mapping is just so important in terms of knowing what your territory physically looks like, as well as the biological work that's ongoing now in terms of what's above it.
Yeah, I totally agree about the importance of mapping. I mean, I work a lot in the Northeast Atlantic here in Irish territorial waters, and the seabed maps that have been produced for Ireland have been so useful in that work. And that is lacking to a great extent in the Seychelles. Sometimes when we were looking at charts, the last time that there was any data produced was in the 1800s. So one of the things that the expedition was doing was mapping. So we were producing our own bathymetry maps. Partly this informed our science. It's very dangerous to dive with submersibles when you've got no idea what's below you. So we were trying to produce maps of the areas before we dived. But we had a team out in a small boat with multibeam on board, mapping every day, basically, while we were running other operations off the mothership. Now, you've said already about the size of the Indian Ocean territory. What we did is a tiny, tiny part of that. So it obviously needs further initiatives. And you know, as Ken said, there are minerals in the Indian Ocean. There will be likely attempts to license areas. There's probably things like cobalt and rare earth minerals there as well. There is probably a high chance that somebody is going to want to exploit some of the seabed. And so mapping going forward will be, I think, a really important thing to achieve.
I saw a documentary on TV recently about mining for diamonds off the coast of South Africa.
Mm.
And you could have knocked me down with a feather. I didn't know this stuff was going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
at sea.
The last time I was working, Louise, in Greenland some years ago, and the amount of exploration that was going on, the number of different languages that were being spoken in the ports, all of this was going on in huge areas of the ocean being looked at, particularly as the ice retreated up through the Northwest Passage. And there were all sorts of new technologies.
But we should be worried about this, surely, to God, Ken.
I think it has to be managed. And I think that's where these international agreements, there's one called UNCLOS, which is the agreement for the management of the seas. Those sort of agreements are absolutely critical in terms of making sure that we're ahead of the posse in relation to this. And that's why there's been a lot of debate in terms of the territories in the Antarctic. The Arctic and the Antarctic. A lot of those, thankfully, have already, by agreement, been preserved. But we still have to be conscious of the fact that the areas such as Louise is looking at and these other areas within the Indian Ocean and some of the other bigger oceans, we really, as I say, need to be ahead of the game in this. And it's a very difficult mix between trying to get all of the factors together and mobilised in terms of fighting climate change issues, while at the same time trying to look at resources and alternatives. And I think that's really where we have to start looking, is looking very broadly and trying to get all this mapping done. And mapping is absolutely fundamental to what we're about.
Yeah, and even if the world's really progressive and decides to leave all the oil and gas in the seafloor that is there, I think people are still going to come for rare earth metals. You know, we need it in all our mobile technology and all this kind of thing, and that's not going to go away. Even if we divest ourselves of fossil fuels completely, people are still going to come mining for the deep ocean. Yeah, you need data to make an informed decision.
Yeah, no numbers, no management. I mean, that's always my mantra.
Anyway, Louise, thank you very much indeed. And we'll put a link on our website, rte.ie/mini. Louise Alcock, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, there are about 5,500 species of mammal on the planet. Did you know that? 10,000 different bird species. And around 160,000 named species of flies. And some experts say that the real figure is closer to 800,000. While the public profile of flies is often that of dirty, disease-carrying, buzzing-annoying, egg-laying pests, it is, without doubt, true to say that they do enormous service to the planet too, cleaning up our waste, pollinating plants, and forming a vital link in the food chain as both predators and prey. As 2019 is the year of the fly, Éireann Ní Lána sought out Erica McAllister, Senior Curator of Flies and Fleas at the Natural History Museum in London.
Well, I've always been interested in insects. Insects have been a lifelong interest because once you start learning about the flies, you realise that they just do absolutely everything. So for my mind, it was fascinating that I can watch something stabbing something or something doing something nasty to something else or something benefiting, and it's all in just one order of insects.
Yes, indeed, because we talk about flies and we think of mayflies, butterflies, dragonflies,
dragonflies, caddisflies, green flies, but actually none of them are actually flies as such.
Exactly.
So what is a fly? It's a member of the Diptera family. So tell us the exact scientific definition of a fly.
It's an order of insects, and the definition, and this is what I love about flies, because I'm going to tell you a definition and I say, by the way, that's wrong for many of them. So one pair of wings, so for the Diptera, so that's where the name comes from, they all have suctorial mouthparts, which, so when someone says you've been bitten by a fly, it's technically not correct. And they have these most amazing structures called halteres, which are their balancing organs. And this is what enables flies to land upside down, to be able to loop the loop. They can do all these crazy aerobatics. But there's lots of flies that don't have any of those. So, sorry.
Yes, so this is it. Well, I think Diptera, the fact that they have two wings seems to be, because the other ones I mentioned, mayflies and dragonflies and butterflies, different groups, so they all have four wings anyway.
Four wings, absolutely.
Yes, indeed. And do they have their taste buds on their feet, or is that a...
They have their taste buds all over them. They are, and they're hairy things, and these are, they're either connected to mechanical receptors on the body or chemoreceptors. So they taste with their feet. It's exactly what this thing, but they taste with their head. They taste all over themselves.
We always think about animals in the world as somehow, you know, they have to justify their existence. And I spend a lot of time saying this, that and the other. But can you tell me the justification for the existence of bluebottles? Everybody hates them.
Okay, if we didn't have blue bottles, you'd be swimming around in a quagmire of feces. We need them to get rid of the waste. We also need them to get rid of these decomposing bodies. Just think of the pestilence. If you're, you know, if all these bodies were just lying around all over the place, I don't think that would be a particularly pleasant environment for most people. So they're working away to consume this mass to make everything nicer for us.
So therefore, if you suddenly discover there's loads of blue bottles as the summer approaches now and it's getting warm, is this a reflection of the environment in which you live that there's lots of stuff for these flies to be eating?
Sometimes, yeah, or it could be, we had a lady came into work once and she brought in a load of blue bottles and I'm like, oh dear. But it was an indication when the pest people came in, they killed all the squirrels in her loft, but didn't remove the decomposing bodies. So sometimes it's just because it's the time of year and they've all emerged, or others it's because there's a hint, there's a story going on that they need to explore.
But we tend to think of these blue bottles as horrible things. But let's try and start at something more positive. Flies are important pollinators. They behave in a different way to, say, bees and things like that. I'm just thinking this time of the year now, we have our arum lilies in the woodlands, these lovely flowers that come out of lords and ladies. And the smell of the spadix is not a beautiful perfume that you get on your flowers. It smells horrible. So these are specifically smell like rotten flesh in order to attract the flies. So tell us how it works, because it's a really interesting one, isn't it?
So this is called Sapromyophily. Basically, they're trying to attract the animals that go to the rotten flesh. And there's a great family of flies called Sarcophagidae. They're called flesh flies. They're very distinctive. They've got grey and black marks on their back, a lot of them. And plants are trying to mimic these corpses to get the males to come along and to cover themselves, basically, as they're getting the nectar, cover themselves in pollen. And they're amazing. You can see pollen balls are huge. It's like having like small children stuck to you. This is the size comparison of what these flies are flying around doing. A lot of these plants are really sneaky as well, and they would trap them for 24 hours. They've got guard hairs. So as the fly squeezes in, it triggers a mechanism and the plant kind of closes in. So it forces these little flies to kind of move around inside them, covers them with these pollen grains, and then 24 hours later it releases them to go off to another plant.
So they do pollinate. And in fact, there are some important crops for us that depend on flies to pollinate them, aren't there?
For you, yes. For me, no. Because there's the one that's the very famous one and I can't stand it. It's chocolate.
Yeah.
I think it's I really don't like chocolate.
But the
it's
chocolate,
ironic.
The cocoa, there's a cocoa beans and they come.
Yeah, the cocoa plant is pollinated by, I believe, about 15 species of the biting midge. So the thing that everybody hates, actually, they're really, really important pollinators.
So that if we abolished all the flies, as people would love, say, let's get rid of all the flies in the world, we would never have any chocolate again.
Nope, no chocolate. Most of the carrots are pollinated by flies. Sweet peppers. There's loads of things that we commonly eat. Mangoes that are... most of the pollinators are flies.
So the bees and the wasps are at the races too, but the flies are hugely important in that area.
Very much so. There's a lot of ones that have co-evolved with flies. So they're very long tube flowers and they have flies with very, very, very long mouthparts. So if you got rid of these flies, those plants would die out immediately.
Now, some flies creatures we don't see any use for at all, and I'm speaking of mosquitoes. Mosquitoes carry disease, they're bad articles, we should get rid of them all. But it's only the female mosquitoes, I fear to say, to do all of this. The male mosquitoes are actually very useful, aren't they?
The males are vegetarians, they're all pollinators. So there's one specifically that is a keystone pollinator. If you get rid of it, you get rid of an orchid species. So the mosquitoes can live in very adverse conditions where don't favour many other species. So you get rid of them, you're getting rid of these very important pollinators. There's 3,500 species of mosquito, of which only about 150 of them are important vectors. They are acting as vectors. It's not them themselves that actually do the damage. I'm much more in favour of eliminating malaria itself, or working on halting the disease transmission rather than wiping out mosquitoes per se. We don't know enough about the ecology in some environments to say, let's eradicate this entire species. I think another species may come in, you see, and take over the role. So it's better that we kind of start thinking about a holistic approach to getting rid of these diseases.
They have an amazing way of bodies, because flies only drink, they don't actually eat. So they actually have to soak up their food as a liquid. How does that work?
So it depends which species you are. So the big housefly, the one we all recognise, the one that I affectionately call the vomiters. So these will release externally a digestive fluid which breaks down the food substance. Horseflies, which everyone hates but I think are marvellous creatures, they've got 6 pumps in their head to work out how to take up all these different fluids.
The other interesting thing, I think, is the fact that generally insects have 4 wings, 2 front wings, 2 back wings. So they reckon that the 2 back wings of the diptera turned into these sort of halteres, as you were calling them, you know, like rudders. So, I mean, presumably evolution happens for a purpose. So what good are these, or how do they operate? What do they do?
Well, I mean, these are balancing organs. So these are proprioceptors. So they are able much better to actually figure out where the fly is in sense of itself, in sense of space. So a fly is able to act so far. I'm not advocating this, but people who try and spot flies, the success rate is pretty low, because the fly not only is able to see you, it's able to react so fast to the situation that's going on. So, and if you disturb it, if you tilt it, if the airflow changes, these little receptors are able to tell the fly which way to go and stabilise itself. So if you cut off the halteres, which don't do because that's horrible, the fly has a serious problem trying to manipulate itself.
So it loses its balance, like...
Yeah, it looks like a little drunken idiot.
No, I mean, they are very helpful creatures, these flies in general. I mean, I love this word, debridement. Debridement sounds like a lovely bride on her wedding day, but it isn't anything to do with a bride on her wedding day.
No, in fact, if it was going on in the wedding day, something's gone wrong.
So what's debridement? Tell us what it is.
Debridement therapy is utilising what maggots do best, and that is eating, to get rid of our rotten flesh. So this is not a new practice. This has been going on for thousands of years. The Mongols practiced it. And it was the American Civil War that they first really started noticing that the soldiers whose wounds were infected with these maggots, their wounds healed faster and they looked better in the end. Because not only is the maggot eating this decomposing flesh, it is releasing an enzyme which gets rid of bacteria. So things like MRSA, it's fabulous, but it also causes the skin to bind better. So it's a beautiful little mechanism going on.
But you have to gaze at these white maggots on your flesh.
No, not anymore, sadly, because people are a little bit sensitive. They now come in what looks like a tea bag. So you have this tea bag put on your wound, and the mouth parts of these maggots They've got no real head structure, but they have what looks like a pirate's hook for a mouth part, and this is able to reach through the teabag and scrape off this decomposing material.
And cause people to be healed and well. So,
yeah.
And they're used even in this day and age. I mean, if they were there since the time of the Mongols,
yeah.
They're still as effective as ever.
They're even better now. So the NHS, you can get this therapy on the NHS. There's a maggot nurse in Cardiff who's championing this because you in hospitals now, because of the resilience to penicillin and things like this, this is one of the only ways. When you've got patients with type 2 diabetes, you get massive ulcers. A lot of the times these aren't healing. And people are getting gangrene these days. I mean, it's ridiculous that we've got
this. Of course, gangrene is rotten flesh, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the only way to get rid of them is to get these maggots onto them.
And it works well. So, I mean, yes. Avert your eyes if you don't want to look. In fact, the whole life cycle of the fly is very interesting because you have the adult, they lay their eggs, the eggs hatch out into the maggots, and the maggots then, these white legless creatures, pupate, then we eventually end up with it again. So, in fact, by knowing the life cycle, by knowing how long each stage takes, they've been able to help us with forensics, have they not?
Yes. So, I mean, we've been using them for forensics for thousands of years. There's a beautiful case with a Chinese medicine man. He was able to ascertain which of the villagers had murdered one of the other villagers because the flies were attracted to the blood. So as much as he thought he'd cleaned his scythe, in the sun, in the warm weather, the flies were able to pick out which one had the blood on. So we were able to incriminate then. But technology has enabled us to study the development of the maggots under different temperatures, in different environmental conditions, all these sorts of things. So by turning up at a crime scene, we can look at the maggot and go, do you know what, that body has been here for so-and-so weeks. And we can able to give a time reference.
Because it took that long for the egg to hatch out into this state and it was laid on the dead body, so this is how long it took. So it gives you a time scale.
Absolutely. I work with some colleagues who are doing some fantastic stuff with micro-CT, so computer tomography. They are able to look inside the pupa at its development to be able to tell you now within hours what's going on. In a previously unknown event, we can now give the police better timings.
Do you get called out a lot from the museum for this sort of work?
My colleagues do, yes. So it is something, they're recognised experts, so they will go and do this. So it's done with care and a lot of sensitivity in most cases.
They've also contributed, haven't they, to our knowledge of genetics?
Yes. Yeah, we have to thank one fly particularly for that, Drosophila melanogaster. And it's the model organism. It's fantastic. It helps us understand everything we want to know about inherited diseases, understand about all the genetics and now behaviour as well. Like, we get this fly drunk because it's unethical to get humans drunk. We get the fly drunk to understand the impact of alcohol on genes. So all of these sorts of things that we didn't know we could do. This little fly as well was the first animal into space. So we've been using it for our own benefits for hundreds of years now.
It was great talking to you today, Erica. Thank you very much for all of this information.
Thank you.
Now, Ken, I have a question for you, if you're ready. Have you got your thinking cap on?
Oh, not too difficult. Yeah. Please, not too difficult.
Can I just ask you, is that your sleeping cap or your thinking cap you're wearing?
Oh, this is my thinking cap now. Serious thinking cap.
You know mine because it says D on it for Derek. Anyway, can you name a bird that actively enters the water to feed?
I think that might be the dipper.
Correct. The answer is the dipper. You may see a dipper flying fast and straight along the surface of a river, but watch them when they land and dip underwater in search of insect larvae, such as caddisfly or mayfly. At this time of year, they are nesting, and their nests are commonly found under old bridges. Declan Murphy from Birdwatch Ireland recently got in touch to share his experiences of dippers, and in particular, a nesting pair he's been watching in County Wicklow. Terry Flanagan went off to the Garden County to find out more.
God, Declan, this is beautiful here, this river. What river is it?
This is the Avonmore River, and it's a lovely evening here this evening. And the Avonmore River flows for over 30 kilometres. Mm-hmm. And rivers are a very challenging environment. They're fast flowing, they're cold, they're surrounded by slippery rocks. And any animal or bird that has adapted to live in the river is usually quite specialised. And the reason we're here tonight is we're looking at an extremely specialised bird. We're here to look at the dipper. Now, the dipper is a bird that I've watched for many, many years, and most bird watchers will be very familiar with and see on a very regular basis. And yet it's a bird an awful lot of people will not have heard of, and they will never have seen. It's a very specialised bird. They're unique amongst all the passerines. Passerines are perching birds. It's the only perching bird that swims and dives. It's semi-aquatic. All the other birds we see on rivers, mallard, moorhen, herons, they're not passerines, they're not perching birds. So this bird is unique. And there's actually only 5 species in the entire world
of dippers.
Of dippers. Mm-hmm. Yes. And this is, its full title is the white-throated dipper. But in Ireland, we call it just the dipper.
Are we going to get to see one tonight now? Yeah.
We should get to see them. There's quite a number of pairs on this stretch of river. And once we get our eye in, we should pick them up. Because a lot of people wouldn't have seen them before. And so they can be hard to see if you're not familiar what to look for. They're about the size of a blackbird.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're kind of stumpy.
They're very stumpy, round birds. They're very, very distinctive when you see them, and they perch on the rocks in the middle of the river. But they're very dark. They're seen from behind. They have a very dark, sooty black body.
I presume that's an adaptation or kind of camouflage.
Yes, because it blends in with the river from behind. Now, their head is slightly browner. When they fly away from you, you just get a glimpse of something dark, chunky bird, flapping wings, disappearing down the river, and you'll say that could be anything. But when it turns around, it has this beautiful white bib. It's so pristine, it's amazing, and it just glows against the darkness of the river banks or the river itself.
But you know what I love about them too? I know whenever I see a dipper or a pair of dippers, it's telling me that this water is pristine. It's absolutely clear water. Whether it's a dipper or whether it's a kingfisher, I know that.
They are all what's known as indicator species, mm-hmm. and you're quite right, because the way the food chain works, they're a great indicator of a healthy river. They feed on stonefly larvae, caddis larvae, mayfly larvae, and they all require very oxygenated water mm-hmm. to thrive. And that's what we have here. And the birds that feed here are very specialised, and the dipper does have some extremely unique adaptations to help it survive in this really challenging environment. Compared to other birds, it has very dense plumage.
Mm.
And this plumage is heavily waterproofed. They have an oil gland at the base of their tail, and the dipper spends an awful lot of time preening. And you'll see it reaches round, preens the base of the tail, it's getting a small little bit of oil on it, and it rubs that oil off the feathers. And it basically makes it completely waterproof. And you'll see when the bird goes into the water and it comes out, it's like little beads of mercury just about coming off, little shiny droplets just drop off. It's a very robust bird. It's quite it's chunky, and it's very strong legs and claws. And
of course, it needs them to cling on to the rocks.
Yes, because the bit that when you first see it, you say that's a nice bird perched on the rock. What you don't realise is that it dives into the water and swims underwater, and it has short, roundy wings that act like flippers.
Mm-hmm.
And it, because it's very strong current in the Avonmore River here, and when it goes in, it's got to be careful it doesn't get swept away.
Yeah, so it can walk along, can't it?
It can walk along.
Physically walk on
the bottom. It goes onto the bottom of the river, and it has big strong legs and claws, and it can hold onto the rocks while it's feeding. And then it comes up to the surface and eats the food or carries it to the nest, which we will see later on.
And you know where they're nesting?
I do.
Okay, up there, that bridge up above?
There's a bridge up there. Why don't we walk up and have a look?
Bring me up, and we'll go to your hide. Do you get to see them much during the rest of the year?
Yes, and February actually is one of the best months to see them because they're displaying and they're courting, and the courtship and display is fascinating to watch. I mean, I watch it for hours and I never tire of it. The male has a very loud song. It has to be very loud because it carries over the roar of the water, and it's a bit like a blackbird mixed in with a warbler. But when the male is singing, quite often the female approaches him. And then they do this sword display, it's called, where the both of them point their bills up in the air. And the male holds out his wings and starts flapping them, a bit like a little ballerina almost.
Lovely.
And does a little twirling dance with his bill pointed up. And when he's doing that, the female lowers her bill and bows before him and spreads the wings out.
True love.
Absolutely true love. It's gorgeous to see. And it's one of the highlights of the year for dippers. When you see that, it's an insight into the private life of an animal that you really, it makes you be so appreciative of what you've seen. It's a privilege to actually see something like that, and I never tire of it, and I hope I never will.
Well, I know we're not going to get to see that now, but come on, we'll go up and see, can we see them when they're actually nesting?
So now, Terry, I'd like you to come on into the hide and join me while we have a look at these dippers under the bridge here.
This is not a hide, this is a car. I was expecting something like the hide you had for the woodpeckers.
Well, the woodpecker hide I built, and that was at a permanent nest site. But when you're watching dippers, you need to be mobile and to be moving up and down the river. So,
well, come on, let's get in.
It's easier to let you use the
So where exactly is the nest? Somewhere under the bridge there, is it?
Yes, it's under the bridge here in front of us. And like most dipper nests, it's located over the deepest part of the river.
Right.
Which is almost always the centre or slightly to one side. Now, the bridge in front of us, the near side to where we're sitting, is very, very shallow. And the far side of the river is extremely deep. And that's
there he is.
Just come in on the rock just below the far side of the bridge.
Right.
Now, he's doing his very characteristic
bobbing and dipping.
That's where they get the name, of course, from his dipper. Now, I'm just looking now, and he has food in his bill. Now, the young have only hatched.
Right.
So they're still quite small. And the invertebrates that he's bringing in are very, very small. And as the chicks get older, you can see the food they're bringing in becomes larger and larger to accommodate the larger appetite of the chicks that are in the nest. And there he flies up. Yes. He's gone into the nest, right in the middle of the bridge. And there's the other one. That's the female. And look, the two of them are together now. Oh, that's lovely. He's actually singing. The male is actually doing a display song to the female. Do you see the way the male is perched on the near rock and he was pointing his bill skyward?
Yes.
And that was actually a display to the female. The female is the one slightly to the left.
Yeah.
Now, that is a great opportunity to tell the differences that we were talking about earlier. Mm. The male is 25% larger than the female usually.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there he goes.
Although he's gone back up to the nest.
Yeah. That's him that's gone up?
I think that's the male. Because that's the one that was doing the little dance and the song.
Now, look, he's gone back out again.
He's gone up the river. He's gone up the river to feed, and the female is still there. Now, that female, she came in after him. I'll just check in my binoculars, see, does he have... Yes, she still has food. She still has food with her. Now, what he did that time, when he flew up to the nest first, he fed the chicks, then he flew down to her, and he flew up a second time. And what he would have been doing that time was he would have been trying to take a fecal sac from one of the chicks and flying out. Oh, there's the female. The female just flying past. Oh, no, she's not. She's coming very close, actually. Yes.
Well, look at her.
She's bobbing there on the rock in front of us. And look how the white bib gives
her
the name.
It?
It's just glowing against the river. Now, the river at this hour of the evening is lovely. I mean, you can just see it there in front of us.
And a lovely flow on it, isn't there?
Yes. It's flat, calm. And you've just got this little kind of, foam and little, like suds on the top of a wash basin, really, just drifting past. As she's sitting there on the rock, she seems to have dropped the food. She looks very content.
She is.
She's not bothered with us at all. They're quite accustomed to people along here. They're quite obliging birds. They're very, very tolerant. But this is the reason, Terry, that, as we said earlier, that although they're a widespread bird, and we're sitting here watching them, I think the male just flew back into the nest.
The female's gone up as well.
Yeah. So the two of them are in the nest now.
He's
just shot down.
And the two of them are gone.
The two of them are gone. They are, aren't they? But as I was saying there, we're getting great views here. Yeah. And every couple of seconds or every few minutes, we are seeing these birds coming in and out. And they're a very widespread bird. There's a pair here, there's another pair a kilometre up, there's another pair a kilometre downstream. And yet, an awful lot of people will never have seen one in all their lives, let alone even heard of them. And the reason for this is they're confined to the river here in front of us. Yeah. So
it's a linear habitat they have.
It is, yeah. It's a linear habitat, and unlike many other water birds that would use like the river, like a heron or a mallard, but they go off the river as well. So the heron will fly off, it'll fly over a lake, it'll fly down to the beach, and people will see them.
And it nests, of course, in trees.
Exactly. But dippers don't move from the river. And as you said, it's a linear habitat, and it's quite narrow.
Yeah.
You only have to look, it's only about 10, 15 metres wide here, and it's a kilometre long. So that's where they get their large territory from. But unless you're within 10, 12 metres of the river, you're not going to see one.
Mm-hmm.
And an awful lot of people, they'll walk a lot, they're on the roads sort of thing, and the river is very close by. There's a dipper just come in,
yeah,
and he's gone into the water beside us, just on the bank underneath us. You can see the ripples just coming out from the edge of the bank there. You can see all the ripples in the water. Just on the right hand side of the bank here, Jerry.
Yeah, I'm
looking quite close.
On our side. I still can't see him.
He's just round that little bit of green mound there on the right-hand side.
But they are very active, aren't they? It's about 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening
now. That's right, but it's a lovely evening now, and I would be here most evenings, and yesterday evening it was very, very dull, and the birds were a little less active. Now, on top of that, the birds are a day... There's
he's
gone back in again. The birds are a lot more active because the chicks are growing.
And like all birds, an extra day or two makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Like, you know yourself, like, these chicks, like all passerines, are born naked.
Mm-hmm.
And within 4 or 5 days, they've got feathers.
Yeah.
And then another 4 or 5 days, the eyes are open. The development is really, really fast. So 24 or 48 hours isn't very much, but the appetite of those chicks can increase hugely.
And so, how long will they spend in the nest now?
Usually about 17 days. 17 mm-hmm. to... 17 to 24 is the
max.
Is the maximum, really. So that gives you an average of 20 with 21. But usually with the Irish dippers, it's about 17. They nest early, and the young will have fledged, you know, about 24 days after the eggs hatch, and then it's time to go. The parents carry on feeding them around the river for the next few weeks after that, but they only have the one brood usually.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks also to Ken Whelan. Ken, good luck with your trip to Seattle.
Thank you very much indeed,
at
Derek.
The Salmon Conference. Our researcher is John Riley and the producer is Anna Leddy. Until next time, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.